I want to continue talking about the kind of behavior that you can observe in clinics, and the considering with you the question of the degree to which and the ways in which you can transfer this behavior to situations outside clinics in everyday life. I'm assuming that the behavior that we see in clinics is among the finest behavior that we see among human beings. It's behavior of people who are trying to be understanding and who are trying to realize their own potentials as best they can to solve the problems which they recognize and are willing to face up to. This seems to me to be very fine behavior. I don't think that it should be limited to clinics. So let's describe it some more and be asking ourselves, is this behavior which we might possibly be able to cultivate to advantage in the situations which we meet hour by hour, day by day? Counseling is the kind of behavior, is the name that we're giving to the facets of the behavior that we see in clinics that we're talking about. Counseling tends to have effects. It is a relationship which tends to affect the people who are in the relationship, and particularly the person who is trying to deal with his own problems with the aid of a counselor. This kind of relationship with another person that we call counseling tends to induce the individual to do something which we can call ventilating. Not just talking about the problem, but talking about his feelings about the problem is what is meant by ventilating. There's something about our mores, our commonly accepted codes of behavior, which tends to inhibit this kind of behavior. And I think we need to look at this a minute. If you read any textbook, psychiatry, clinical psychology, counseling, psychotherapy, you will encounter the general point of view, probably, that one of the things which happens, and probably to advantage in the clinical encounter, is that the person who goes to the clinic for help or to deal with his own problem more effectively very often indulges in behavior that is called cathartic. He lets his hair down and gets it off his chest, as it were. Now, what's the point of this? Is this good, or is this just a sign of weakness? It's something that is not usually done at formal dinner parties. Why not? Does this mean that it's not good to do? Well, here again, I think we see that the behavior that is encouraged in clinics tends to have better effects than some of the behavior that is encouraged in the best dining room. Among good friends, there's a good deal of this, cathartic, ventilating. The a large part of the method that is called psychoanalysis consists of this kind of behavior on the part of the person who is going through the analysis, as it were. He lies on a couch and presumably talks as fast as he can and with all the feeling that he has to talk with, and presumably holds nothing back. A counseling relationship tends to encourage this sort of highly honest behavior, the expression of the feelings that you really have, instead of the kind of behavior that we indulge in when we're trying to make a good impression. Now, what's the point of it? Well, partly, I think, it's a good way to get a more valid picture of yourself and of your situation and your relationships with other people. A good way to gather the data, as it were. It's the poor man's scientific method. It's every man's scientific method. I don't mean the poor man. That was a poor choice of adjectives. Every man's scientific method. It's a way to be thorough. And there's something mysterious about it, too, as far as I'm concerned. Doing it tends to be followed by feeling better. Now, my, this gets complicated if you try to apply it in daily life. It's been applied quite a lot by child psychologists in advising parents. And so there are a number, I don't know how big a number, of children who have been encouraged to be themselves, even in rather obnoxious ways. So they go around kicking shins. Well, I think we have to balance this in daily life against something that was once said by Ovid, the poet, to be lovable you must, or to, I spoiled it, to be loved you must be lovable. And you're not very lovable when you're kicking shins. And I think it can be a disservice to a child to encourage too much ventilation, too much self-expression of a rather uninhibited kind in situations where this will elicit reactions that will complicate his relationships with other people. But it does seem to me that everybody can use a screaming hut or a screaming partner to good advantage at the right times. And that's what good friends are for sometimes, and that's what husbands and wives are for sometimes. And I think this tends to be forgotten in some idealistic pictures of human relationships, such as a marriage relationship. You can be so nice so long that you become sick. I've already indicated that part of the effect of this ventilation is that it does make the facts more clear. It is a way to be thorough. I don't want to give the impression that all that happens in a counseling relationship is that people scream. This tends not to happen a great deal. From some of the books you read, you think that there's a lot of it. Not much of it. Most people don't have too much screaming to do. And if you find that you don't have any to do, I don't think you need to worry about it. That's all right. It's probably either you're very fortunate or you don't know how bad off you are, and I suppose that's true. Might have its advantages at times, too. Most of the talking that goes on in a counseling relationship is pretty sensible and is very earnest. It's an earnest endeavor to state the facts much more adequately than one usually would. It is clarifying. This is one of the main effects of counseling, clarification of the situation that needs to be understood and dealt with. It encourages much more observing than one would ordinarily do of the relevant things to be observed. It encourages a kind of reporting of what one finds out by observing. It encourages the person to evaluate and reevaluate the things that he thinks are important in the problem, the conclusions that he may have come to about other people or about himself, about a situation. He tends to reevaluate on the basis of this more clarified, more thorough discussion. I put another term here, homework, because I think that there is a tendency all too often for us to get the idea that we go to a clinic and everything that is accomplished in the clinic. Or we seem to think too often in everyday life that once we have had a pretty reasonable, good relationship with a person on a given hour at a given day, then we can pay no attention to what we do the rest of the time. And there is no follow-through on this. Did I tell you about the mother who called a friend of mine who had been working with her little boy who had a problem? The little boy had a problem. And my friend had advised her to be more affectionate with the little boy, pay more attention to him when he wants to talk to you. Spend more time with him, be a little better, try to develop a better relationship with him. And so the mother worked at this pretty well, and she called him after about a month or two, and she said, "Well, problem seems to be solved. How soon can I go back to treating Johnny normally?" There's homework to be done here. This isn't just something you talk about. The most important effects of the counseling relationship is that the individual involved begins to act as though he had been in this relationship. He begins to act as though he had learned something from it. He practices behaving as though he had learned something in the counseling relationship. It doesn't do much good to talk about good adjustment. Someone has said that the trouble with Sunday school is that you can't go on forever talking about being good. That's what's the trouble with some psychoanalysis and other kinds of psychotherapy. You just can't go on forever talking about being well adjusted. Finally, you've got to do some adjusting. Begin acting as though you had been to the clinic. Begin acting as though you'd been to Sunday school. Otherwise, it gets almost uncomfortable to go anymore. You get tired talking about things. So there's homework to be done. How would you act if you were to apply what you've learned in this good relationship that you've had? Well, simply practice acting that way. This is what the homework consists of. Let's have the next slide. What kind of behavior, if you're a counselor, do you encounter in the people with whom you try to interact effectively? How do they react to the counseling relationship? Now, take this out of the clinic again. What kind of behavior do you encounter in other people with whom you try to develop effective relationships? It's not much different outside the clinic, I think, from what it is inside. And what you notice, though, when you put people under the microscope of the clinic, as it were, of the counseling relationship, is that their behavior tends to be describable or to be classifiable in certain ways more than other ways. I suppose the thing that anybody who does this kind of work notices most is the defensiveness of people. Even when they have decided they're going to do something about the problem, most people have been so educated or trained, or they've gotten by osmosis from their culture a kind of attitude which makes it very difficult for them to admit that maybe they need to improve. It's very difficult for them to say quite matter-of-factly that they've been mistaken about something, that they have been wrong. I think that the greatest thing you could give a child, I've probably said this before, I say it several times a week, I think, the greatest thing you could give a child is the attitude that he welcomes criticism. He wants it. He goes and gets it. He pays for it if necessary. The resentment of criticism is probably the most pervasive epidemic we have, and in its overall effect, while each incident of it may look somehow trivial, the overall effect is practically a plague. Now, I don't know whether it does any good to say that. It would be interesting to be able to follow everybody in this room around for the next 48 hours and see if my saying that made any difference. Suppose it would? I don't think it'd make much difference. I think that what is necessary is much more than hearing something like this said. And one of the effects of the counseling relationship and of this type of relationship in everyday life is that the people involved in it tend to become more accepting of the kind of information which they need in order to improve. Information which they up to then had been classifying as criticism and rejecting. This is classificatory behavior. It is evaluative behavior. There is no such thing in nature as criticism. There's just information. It only becomes criticism when you classify it as such. And you don't resent it till you classify it as criticism. One of the very most wonderful things that comes out of the counseling relationship and out of this type of relationship in daily life between people is the ability to be comfortable with frankness. the defensiveness is what tends to melt as counseling succeeds. People tend in a counseling situation to become more effectively communicative. And they start out, one thing you notice in many people who come to a clinic is that they're relatively inarticulate, as I have tried to say in people's quandaries. They're relatively inarticulate. You ask them, what's the problem, what's the matter, and they don't do very well in answering this. They don't formulate the problem very well. They don't quite know what's the matter. And so, of course, they're mystified by what seems to be an undesirable situation that they don't understand. They're inarticulate about it. And this is complicated by the fact that they have been brought up, almost all of us, to feel that it's highly necessary or at least desirable to make a good impression on others. And that the way to do this is to seem to have nothing the matter with you. To seem to have no problems. Goodness, this is unfortunate as a kind of teaching or something that we tend to learn. You know, almost the opposite is true. If you want to fall in love, the best way is not to put the better foot forward, but the worse foot forward. Well, sure, the other person will try to top it. If you tell about your pains and sufferings and inadequacies and inferiorities and homeliness and so forth, and know how you suffer, the other person will top it, and you'll become fast friends. But if you try to make a good impression by pretending there's nothing wrong with you, you'll just alienate everybody. Nobody can react to that. What can you do with it? All anybody can do, if you really are able to carry this off, is to feel inferior to you. And this isn't comfortable. This isn't likable. It's a most unfortunate kind of attitude that many of us are encouraged to grow up with, that there's something desirable about always trying to pass yourself off as being hot stuff. You're much more likable when you're not always better than everybody else. I had two conversations last week, about a week or so ago, I don't know, fairly recently. I think they were 2 days on two successive days that were very impressive along this line. They underscore the point I'm trying to make. I was talking with a man who found himself in a business, more or less suddenly, in which he had to make a lot of public speeches to clubs and various groups as part of the work he was doing. And he had no training for this. He said he debated taking a Dale Carnegie course or something like this and had decided against it because he felt that he probably would be more effective if he weren't too polished a speaker, if he would sort of fumble around and give the listener something to worry with him about. I thought he was terribly wise. I've always, or for a long while, ever since I have had occasion to have any opinion about such things, had a deep conviction that the very smooth speaker tended to be relatively ineffective. It's so hard to react to it. Either he says everything and there's nothing left to say, or he seems to, or he talks so fast that you can't think with him. Now, anyway, I don't enjoy a glib speaker, a so-called good speaker. It leaves me usually, on the average, as a rule, he doesn't impress me as much as one who is obviously thinking while he talks and maybe saying some things that sound kind of stupid and then trying to recover from them. And this is interesting, and you can think with a person like this and you can empathize with him. And about the next day, or almost that, I happened to be talking with a person you know, with Forrest Evashevsky, who was a very effective speaker, I think. And it just came up in the conversation. I forget how, but he was telling about his own experience. He has to make more speeches, I suppose, than almost anybody in the university. And he says he prefers to go unprepared. He does better that way. Of course, he's not really unprepared, you see. But he doesn't try to guess ahead of time too exactly what will be best to say when he actually starts talking and sees the reactions. He thinks it's better to sort of fumble your way along, as it were, because people are able to empathize with this better. It gives them something to think about while you're talking. I would always much rather personally hear a speaker get up and talk than to read something. Much rather, even if he were quite inarticulate while he was talking. At least he's alive and he's a person. He's not a talking machine. Well, this is an example of what I'm trying to say. That it pays to be more communicative of yourself. Reveal yourself more. Don't be afraid to show that you don't always know what to say, or if you don't know how to pronounce a word, well, go ahead and mispronounce it. Be human. You're more lovable that way. You're more likable. If you really succeeded in being that person out of the Esquire ad that you admire so, nobody else would be likely to admire you, I think. Anyway, in the counseling relationship, people tend to become more communicative. They're not so cautious after a while about what they say, what they talk about, and what they say about it. They gain more, I guess you could call it, confidence in the sounds they make. They get more of a feeling of being able to afford any impression they may make. It's not that they become careless. Just more able to be themselves as best they can. Well, I think this is something that can be transferred out of the clinic to very good advantage. As a person gets into the counseling relationship, he tends to become more inclined to look into things, to investigate, to reconsider, to ask himself questions he hadn't been asking, to be more investigative. And here again, I think this makes for a more interesting kind of person. One of the techniques of genius, almost, is something that, well, I noticed this about a person I have known for years. When I was a student, he was my favorite professor, and he's become one of my very good friends. And he has there's something he does that has always impressed me as being terribly interesting and worthwhile. He takes what appears to be taken for granted by almost everybody and turns it upside down. And it's amazing how much better it sounds that way, often. Wish I could think of an example real quick. What we've been talking about, it pays to make a good impression. No, it doesn't. Now, how does this sound? It pays to make an impression that is not necessarily good by ordinary standards. Turn it upside down. Be investigating. Take a conclusion that everybody seems to have drawn and settled and forgotten about, and open it up again. It's one of the most effective ways I've ever seen to be creative in very significant ways. A sort of re-examination of the obvious. Motivated. How many of you, let's do something here. Let's have three answers. Let's say hardly at all. Now, let's have some hands. How many of you, you're all going to school, whatever that means to you. How many of you enjoy this greatly? You just can't wait to get up in the morning and be at it again. You really love it. You would rather be doing this than anything that you can think of. How many hands? Look around you. There are a few. I'd say there are about six. I don't know how accurate that is. I think that's about one. How many of you just, maybe you even hate it, but we won't put that down as a separate category. You don't like it much. You really can't say that you really enjoy it. School, study, whatever these words mean, is something you do if you have to, but you really wouldn't. You wouldn't drive 100 miles every day to do it. You do it if you have to, if it's assigned, if you've got to get a degree or something, you'll do it. And it's in that kind of a spirit. You don't like it very much. You don't hate it. Do I get it across? How many hands on that kind of attitude? One, two. At all? At all? Well, I hope you're right. I have been a clinician a little too long to take that at face value, but I... How many would say that you moderately enjoy going to school? Well, there's some of you who haven't held a hand up yet, I think, but maybe it's hard to decide. Anyway, most of you are here. One thing that happens to people in a counseling relationship when it's effective, they're dealing with a problem, you see. They're trying to improve, in some respect. And if the counseling is successful, they become highly motivated. They just love to solve this problem. they're terribly eager to be at it. A high degree of motivation, a great capacity for enjoying what you're doing is, I think, one of the signs of health. Every ounce of energy, so to speak, that you spend having to overcome resistance to doing what you're doing is just wasted. You're the most healthy and the most fortunate when you just love to do what you do. And it's a little difficult from some points of view to see how it would be possible not to just love to learn. Why wouldn't you want to? We're going to be talking a little later about learning to learn. This is, if you want to talk about high-level sanity, you're talking about behavior like this. Tremendous motivation to realize your potential. Tremendous motivation to learn, and to learn to learn. And this tends to be one of the results of an effective counseling relationship. And it tends to be one of the results of very good relationships in daily life. When you see people who like to work together, they're healthy people, as a rule, I think. People who can't wait to get away from their work. I just think they're sort of sad. It's too bad. Maybe it isn't their fault. And if this becomes epidemic, something I think should be done about the culture that produces this sort of thing. You could read an awful lot of books about what goes on in the relationships that are called counseling or psychotherapeutic. You might never be motivated to wonder about one thing that I think is very important in relation to all this. And that's the question of the competence of people to benefit from such relationships. I don't think everybody is equal in this regard. I think there are many varieties of genius, and this is one of them. There are people who are positive geniuses at getting the most out of their relationships with other people. And this is something you notice very much in a clinic when you try to help people. I notice, at least, that people differ so very much in what I would call their helpability. With some, it is like pulling teeth. They drag their heels every inch of the way. They want to achieve something. They want to be somehow different from the way they are, but they don't have much heart for it. There's not much enthusiasm. They don't seem to have much ability to learn from the situation. Sometimes this is rather easy to observe in working with some kinds of problems. For instance, stuttering is one. It's quite easy to observe. I've had some persons that I have worked with who did approach genius in their ability to get the most out of the speech clinic. They just had a tremendous capacity for work. They were busy all day long trying to apply what we were trying to teach them. A tremendous capacity not only to work, to spend time, but to be ingenious in the way they did it. And others just don't seem to have this confidence. You practically have to place their foot for every next step, as it were. What do I do next? Sort of attitude, huh? People differ greatly in this. So do students. I mean, not that students are not people. People as students. There is the difference between the student who says, "Do I have to read that?" and the one who says, "Can I read that? Is that all right? You don't object, do you?" Or doesn't even ask. It isn't just the reading. That isn't what's most important. It's acting as though you had read it after you read it. What's the next line? Out of all this, you get some principles. We've referred to these in some context or other in the course. Some of you are also taking Introduction to Speech Pathology and Audiology, and from my point of view, you are not getting a double dose. You're getting a double exposure from different points of view. There's a kind of principle that appears to be helpful in understanding the difference between people who learn well and those who don't. People who seem to improve easily in a counseling situation and those who don't. And in some such terms as I have on the slide, you can talk about this. There are people who have been oriented to a kind of way of perceiving the world. Let's talk about it in the way we usually do. We say some people feel insecure, and they like to be able to depend on the situations they're in. They don't like to leave home. They don't like to move to another town. They don't find it easy to make new friends. They want the ones they've always had. They like a world that stays put and doesn't change. And they like people like this. And of course, in the most extreme forms, we see these persons in the psychopathic hospital, and they're not able to grow up. They don't want to stop being children and become adults. It's just more than they can manage. And so they continue to play with their dolls when other people have long since ceased to, as it were. And there are other people who seem to be adventurous, and they like things to be different. They like change. They like to leave home. They like to make new friends. They like to eat new things and to read new kinds of books and to meet people they've never met before who are as different from themselves as possible. It's a quite different kind of orientation. People like this tend to benefit much more from almost any opportunity to improve. And they react much differently to a clinical situation. And they react much differently to any situation outside of a clinic. Let's have the next slide. Another way to word it. You're familiar by now, perhaps, with these terms. There are some people who seem to be non-lensers, to value their old conclusions and their old habits, their old ways, more than new information and new possibilities and new implications. And there are other people who like new information and who like to work out its implications and who like to change their thinking on the basis of it. These two kinds of people represent two ends of a continuum, of course, of a dimension, and most of us are in between somewhere, sort of vacillating from one side to the other, more or less. But in some such terms as this, I think we can understand the reactions that people make to each other, whether in clinics or elsewhere. What's the next one, Joan? Our time's about up, but let's see where...
The next one is on learning.
Let's see it. Yeah. And we will begin with that next time, and I'll tell you what it's about. It's about the question of what is the relation of old learning to new learning. Does old learning inhibit or facilitate?